I directed Leon Panetta, the director of the CIA, to make the killing or capture of bin Laden the top priority of our war against al-Qaeda. Today, at my direction, the United States launched a targeted operation against that compound in Abbottabad, Pakistan. After a firefight, they killed Osama bin Laden and took custody of his body. Yet today's achievement is a testament to the greatness of our country and the determination of the American people. The cause of securing our country is not complete, but tonight we are once again reminded that America can do whatever we set our mind to. That is the story of our history. Whether it's the pursuit of prosperity for our people or the struggle for equality for all our citizens, our commitment to stand up for our values abroad, and our sacrifices to make the world a safer place. Let us remember that we can do these things not just because of wealth or power, but because of who we are. One nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all. Thank you. May God bless you. May God bless.
This is the era of democracy starts to fade. Some say the eternities already ends.
Yeah, but we can forget about him.
Yeah, it was just one ant.
One ant. You're right. It's just one ant.
Yeah, boss. They're puny.
Puny? Say, let's pretend this brain is a puny little ant.
Did that hurt?
Nope.
Well, how about this one?
Are you kidding?
How about this?
Unlawful assent.
Home away from home. Oh, Canada, sweet, sweet Canada, yeah. Please don't leave me alone. My home away from home.
Issue we have today in Canada and have had for the past couple of years, without a shadow of a doubt, is the economy. But as I constantly remind Canadians, there isn't really a Canadian economy anymore. It is a global economy.
We are a decentralized, nonviolent resistance movement which seeks to restore the rule of law and fight back against the organized criminal class. 1/10 of 1% of the population has consolidated wealth in unprecedented fashion and launched an all-out economic war against 99.9% of the population. We are not affiliated with either wing of the two-party oligarchy. We seek an end to the corrupted two-party system by ending the campaign finance and lobbying racket. Above all, we aim to break up a global banking cartel centered at the Federal Reserve, the International Monetary Fund, Bank of International Settlements and World Bank. We demand the primary dealers within the Federal Reserve banking system be broken up and held accountable for rigging markets and destroying the global economy, effective immediately. As a first sign of good faith, we demand Ben Bernanke step down as Federal Reserve Chairman, a until our demands are met and the rule of law is restored. We will engage in a relentless campaign of nonviolent, peaceful, civil disobedience. In our next communication, we will announce Operation Empire State Rebellion. Operation Empire State Rebellion. Expect us.
At a time when the operation of the machine becomes so odious, makes you so sick at heart, that you can't take part, you can't even passively take part, and you've got to put your bodies upon the gears and upon the wheels, upon the levers, upon all the apparatus, and you've got to make it stop, and you've got to indicate to the people who run it, to the people who own it, that unless you're free, the machine won't be prevented from working at all.
By working together, we can win the first war of the 21st century, and that is the war of cold-blooded killers against cold-blooded killers. The first war of the 21st century, cold-blooded killers against cold-blooded killers.
The human mind is like a computer, no matter how efficient it may be. Its reliability is only as great as the information fed into it. If it is possible to control the input of the human mind, then no matter how intelligent a person may be, and yes, it's even possible to program people to laugh at the mere mention of the word conspiracy.
Using television as the prime example of how mental programming and mind control works, television is the most powerful weapon of psychological warfare in history. And yet, television, for many people, is a member of the family in the household.
What the heck is going on? What the heck is going on?
There's a movie called Loose Change that asserts hundreds, if not thousands, of Americans colluded to kill their fellow citizens on 9/11. That Al-Qaeda didn't attack us. We essentially attacked ourselves. This fairy tale ranks up there with the Holocaust deniers on the vicious scale.
We are living in a virtual reality. We're living in a totally controlled environment, an environment that has been created by mass media. Now, many people, especially young people, accept unquestioningly the reality that is presented by the media. Popular culture, movies, television, music, carry messages about how society works and how people should behave. The ultimate control is to control people without their conscious awareness. Again, television is a prime example. Think back to whenever you have observed young children or older adults sitting, watching television. They have this glassy-eyed, vacant look in their eyes because they are in a trance state, in a hypnotic state of mind.
Now, is Charlie Sheen ranting like a lunatic about the September 11th attacks? Now word comes that Sheen will be narrating a new film about 9/11 conspiracy theories. Joining us now, National Syndicated Radio talk show host Mike.
They do not want you to think too much. That is why our country and our world has become so proliferated with entertainments, mass media, television shows, amusement parks, drugs, alcohol, and every kind of entertainment to keep the human mind entertained so that you don't get in the way of important people by doing too much thinking. You had better wake up and understand that there are people who are guiding your life and you don't even know it.
So there. We have figured it out. Go back to bed, America. Your government has figured out how it all transpired. Go back to bed, America. Your government is in control again. Here's American Gladiators. Watch this. Shut up. Go back to bed, America. Here's American Gladiators. Here is 56 channels of it. Watch these picture-weary retards bang their f***ing skulls together and congratulate you on living in the land of freedom. Here you go, America. You are free to do as we tell you. You are free to do as we tell you.
Oh, good. Honey, I heard on the news that they figured out that the gun, what happened is that there is an echo, and that Kennedy was asking Jackie what it was, and that's why his head flew up. Honey, what time's Gladiator's on? Are we missing it? Woo, I'm so glad we're free, honey.
There has been a long-held consolidation of ownership of the different medias, press, publishing, film, music, television, consolidated ownership into the hands of very few individuals in the multinational corporations. Today, there are a half a dozen multinational corporations that are controlling the information and entertainment choices that people have.
The truth of the matter is that increasingly what we see, what we hear, and what we read is being controlled by fewer and fewer large multinational corporations.
An example, NBC is owned by General Electric. And General Electric is one of the top 10, if not top 5, defense contractors. Is NBC going to expose a news story that might in some way impede a contract negotiation which would mean a lot of money for General Electric? I don't think so. So the point here is that we have elected officials, both Republicrats and Demopublicans, that cater to who? Certainly not the common people. We don't have the huge amounts of money to contribute to their election campaigns. The people that contribute the most amount of money are the corporations. And so that representative or senator is going to do what is going to be in the best interest of those corporations. So if the corporations are controlling and influencing our elected officials, we must also take a look at the mainstream media. Who pays the bulk of the advertising dollars that keep the mainstream network news going? It's the major corporations. So what we have now is we have corporate control of elected officials, corporate control of the media, and this is why some people are now calling it the corporate board, because they have assimilated several different areas of our entire society. The corporations control agriculture, technology, manufacturing, industry, education, communication. They control our elected officials. This is not a government of, by, and for the people. It is a government of, by, and for the corporation. And by definition, when business controls government, that is inescapably fascism.
Now, there are two primary means by which people are manipulated and controlled. One is very simple, very basic, and that is simply the control of information. And the control of, if we don't have all of the facts on any particular topic, then our judgment is going to be no better than the quality of our information.
America forms its opinions by information that's provided to them. And common sense will tell you that if the information that you get from the mainstream media is misinformation or disinformation or even a lie, then common sense will tell you that the opinion is an extension of the lie. Now, unfortunately, America, and indeed the rest of the world, is getting information that's being massaged, it's being spun, it's being prepared for them for consumption.
Television is a massive, massive mass hypnotist to the global mind. And what happens?
Seize you out, slay you alive. One more word and you won't survive. And I'm not scared of your stolen power. See right through you any hour.
We'll be right back.
Good morning. You're listening to CKLN.FM, broadcasting live from Ryerson in Toronto. And this is Blunder News. My name is Shannon. For next, well, certainly less than 2 hours now, we'll be plundering the news. Started off with some quotes there from the illustrious Presidente on the bizarre situation that they've created down there. Today we'll start the first hour with views on the Osama bin Laden assassination and its permutations. We'll move into Canada's election results and its effects. And in the second hour, we'll have an old in-depth interview with Noam Chomsky from many years ago on his pet theories of social anarchism and libertarianism. But we'll start with this clip here from a Matthew Alexander. It's from May 4th off of Democracy Now. And we'll see where that takes us. We'll be right back on Plunder News, CKLN FM.
Yes, when I was in Iraq, and those foreign fighters, the majority of them said time and time again, the reason they had come to Iraq to fight was because of the torture and abuse of detainees at both Abu Ghraib and Guantanamo Bay. And this is not my opinion. The Department of Defense tracked these statistics, and they were briefed to every interrogator who arrived there that torture and abuse was al-Qaeda's number one recruiting tool. And remember, these foreign fighters that came to Iraq, they made up 90% of suicide bombers. They killed hundreds, if not thousands, of American soldiers. And so this policy of torture and abuse did not make America safer. What it did was it caused the deaths of hundreds or thousands of American soldiers who are now buried at Arlington National Cemetery. So this policy has been counterproductive in so many ways. And one thing you'll never hear the torture supporters talk about, Amy, is the long-term negative consequences of torture. They won't talk about the fact that al-Qaeda uses it to recruit. They won't talk about the fact that future Americans are going to be subjected to the same techniques by future enemies using our own actions as justification. They're not going to talk about the fact that it makes detainees more resistant to interrogations as soon as they walk in the interrogation room because they see us all as... So they're not going to talk about all these long-term negative consequences.
Matthew Alexander, you raise an interesting point when you talk about the morality of torture. You compare it to when the U.S. infantry gets bogged down in a battle.
Yeah, and this is one of the things that surprised me most about the conversation, is this lack of faith in interrogators. That by some default, American interrogators aren't good enough, and so we need these special tools to be able to break the law, to be able to do something that's extremely immoral, and forfeit the high ground, as one of my friends likes to say, so that we can do our jobs. And that's an insult to us. Professional interrogators take that as a slap in the face. Any good interrogator who's skilled in his profession understands the culture of the people he's interrogating, respects that culture, uses it to his advantage by respecting it, knows that they don't need torture to accomplish their mission. And this has been repeated time and time again. We don't give exceptions to other career fields to break the law simply because their job is difficult. And interrogators don't need those exceptions either.
Finally, Matthew Alexander, summarize, as you watch this conversation unfold, the fierce defense of torture by Bush administration officials now coming on television saying it was President Bush that laid the groundwork, or his administration and the interrogation techniques, to finding Osama bin Laden.
Well, the laying of the groundwork, if you will, of these techniques, I believe wholeheartedly slowed us down on the road towards Osama bin Laden and numerous other members of al-Qaeda, not just bin Laden. And I'm convinced we would have found him a lot earlier had we not resorted to torture and abuse. And one of the things that also gets lost in this conversation, Amy, is what's our ultimate national security goal here? It's not to stop terrorist attacks. We cannot defeat al-Qaeda. We cannot defeat violent extremism by stopping terrorist attacks. That's an endless game of hide-and-go-seek. What we have to do is stop terrorist recruitment. That's the only way to put an end to al-Qaeda, is when they can no longer recruit fresh fighters. That's been the downfall of numerous terrorist organizations. And when our policies help our enemies to recruit, we end up losing in the long run. So this policy of torture and abuse, what it did is it helped Al-Qaeda recruit, it lowered our moral standing in the world, it sacrificed our principles, and ultimately it cost us more time to find bin Laden, and it'll take us longer to defeat violent extremism.
Matthew Alexander, former senior military interrogator in Iraq, conducted or supervised over 1,300 interrogations. His latest book is called Kill or Capture, How a Special Operations Task Force Took Down a Notorious Al-Qaeda Terrorist. He's a fellow at the UCLA's Berkeley Center for International Relations. This is Democracy Now! Back in a minute.
All right. Thank you, Amy Goodman. Democracy Now! There. Definitely putting through a point of view that I would support. You know, basically anybody who feels safer and thinks that the end of war or terrorism is over is sadly mistaken. You know, one Osama bin Laden may be dead or maybe not. Actually, I tend to sit on the side of the conspiracy theorists. But hey, what if it's real? What difference does it make? Well, actually, now we're going to have six more Osama bin Ladens growing up. Martyrdom has been attained. Thank you. All right, that was Matthew Alexander. Okay, I want to run this piece here. I'm reading an article out of the Toronto Star from Tracy Taylor, legal affairs reporter, on rights and abuses by U.S. grounds for denying extradition court rules. Oh, sorry, let me read that again. Rights abuses by U.S. grounds for denying extradition court rules. A Toronto judge was justified in freeing an alleged Al-Qaeda collaborator given the gravity of the human rights abuses committed by the U.S. in connection with his capture in Pakistan, the Ontario Court of Appeal has ruled. Judges are not expected to remain passive when countries such as the U.S. violate the rights of alleged terrorists, the court said Friday. Its 3-0 ruling upholds a decision last August by Justice Christopher Speyer of Ontario Superior Court of Justice to stay the extradition proceedings involving Abdullah Kadar, who is 30 years old and who is wanted in Boston on charges of procuring munitions for use by Al-Qaeda against U.S. and coalition forces in Afghanistan. The Toronto man is the older brother of Guantanamo detainee Omar Kadar and the son of Ahmad Kadar, who is suspected of having close ties with Osama bin Laden and was killed in a shootout in Pakistan's security forces on the Afghanistan border in 2003. We must adhere to our democratic and legal values. Even if that adherence serves in the short term to benefit those who oppose and seek to destroy those values, said Justice Robert Sharp, writing on behalf of Justices John Laskin and Eleanor Cronk. I just want to read that again. It's a quote here from Justice Robert Sharp. We must adhere to our democratic and legal values, even if that adherence serves in the short term the benefit of those who oppose and seek to destroy those values. For if we do not, in the longer term, the enemies of democracy and the rule of law will have succeeded, he said. They will have demonstrated that our faith in our legal order is unable to withstand their threats. Now here's the story. The U.S. paid Pakistan intelligence agencies and the director of the Inter-Services Intelligence, or ISI, $500,000 to abduct Kadar, a Canadian citizen, in Islamabad on October 15, 2004. He was denied access to courts and consular officials, beaten until he cooperated with the ISI, and detained at a secret location for 14 months. U.S. authorities discouraged a request from the Canadian Security Intelligence Services officer in Pakistan that Kadar be granted access to the Canadian consulate. The U.S. officials wanted Pakistan to allow his rendition to the United States, but Pakistan refused to do so without Canada's consent. Kadar was flown to Toronto on December 2, 2005, and charges were laid in Boston 12 days later. In its ruling Friday, the court said Spare's decision to pull the plug on the American extradition request was a viable way of protecting the integrity of the justice system and distancing Canada's courts from how the U.S. and Pakistan officials behaved. Sending Qatar to Boston would amount to sanctioning human rights abuses, the court said. In quotes here, no doubt some will say that those who seek to destroy the rule of law should not be allowed its benefits, said Sharp. But I do not share that view. There is simply no basis for the federal government's argument that an alleged terrorist will remain at large as a result of Spare's decision to halt the extradition, Sharp added, because Canada's justice minister can prosecute Qatar here for terrorism offenses. While the federal government argued Spare had no right to pass judgment on the legality of Qatar's treatment in Pakistan, the court suggested that that was beyond debate. In quotes again, it surely can come as no surprise that in a country like Pakistan, with a constitution guaranteeing fundamental rights and freedoms, that it is illegal to accept a bounty or bribe from a foreign government to abduct a foreign national from the street, to beat that individual until he agrees to cooperate, to deny him consular access, to hold him in a secret detention center for 8 months while his utility as an intelligence source is exhausted, and then to continue to hold him in secret detention for 6 more months at the request of a foreign power. The Federal Justice Department is considering whether to seek an appeal to the Supreme Court of Canada. Right, so there's a nice example of Canadian courts upholding the rights that people have to justice, even in violation of our law. It's a, which one's greater? Well, this one is decided with individual rights, and I support that. I just thought it was an interesting contrast of ideas between Obama and the extrajudicial killing of Osama bin Laden. You know, never tried, never convicted of a single crime in any country that I know of, but dead for being unarmed in his own home. Just go back to some of the facts that I was able to suss out on this. The story is that 79 U.S. Navy SEALs attacked a large compound containing a three-story home in Pakistan. Obama ordered a covert Title 50 operation in a foreign territory using stealth technology. Only one of the five people killed by the U.S. SEALs was armed and fired a single shot in defense of Osama bin Laden. No U.S. dead. Yet an unarmed Osama bin Laden was shot dead on the third floor in what some intelligence circles describe as a pure kill operation. Osama bin Laden's body was dumped in the sea 12 hours later. And in regards to the conspiracies, we are government. We are governed by conspiracies of capital, finance, corporations, and now terrorism. So, can you believe that Osama is dead or not? Courtesy of bloodthirsty Americans, Obama attains, or so, yeah. Osama attains martyrdom. Presidential extrajudicial killings, but won't release photos on sensitivity issues. He's acting like a brute, but then he has some sensitivity. All right, we're going to get into the next clip here.
Even as we mark this milestone, we should not forget that the battle to stop Al-Qaeda and its syndicate of terror will not end with the death of bin Laden. Indeed, we must take this opportunity to renew our resolve and redouble our efforts. In Afghanistan, we will continue taking the fight to Al-Qaeda and their Taliban allies, while working to support the Afghan people as they build a stronger government and begin to take responsibility for their own security.
We have 30 seconds. Robert Greenwald, your response.
I think it's a horrible statement in every way. The notion of tying the Taliban to Al-Qaeda has been disproved over and over again. They're separate forces. The Taliban is it's a civil war that we're engaged in. And if you could impeach Secretary Clinton for that statement, I think we should impeach her. It's unconscionable after what has gone on, the loss of lives and the loss of money, and for her to continue to try to escalate this misguided war.
All right, so there you go. Another two sides of the story there. I don't know. Find it difficult to accept that the United States can operate with impunity and then expect the rest of the world to follow their rules. It's just, yeah. Sorry, it's police state mentality. And it's not where I live. And it's not fun being on the border with them either. All right, yeah, not fun having a border between them and us. As they try and erase it anyway. All right, more reasons to keep the United States out of our security, i.e. the secret deal that they're cooking up right now. All right, we're going to move into more Canadian affairs. My name is Shannon. You're listening to Plunder News. It's shortly after 9 a.m. Right, we're going to drop this as sort of a Canadian bend on the issue, and we'll be right back.
Thomas Mulcair, should the U.S. release pictures of Osama bin Laden, as many are demanding?
I don't think, from what I've heard, that those pictures exist, and if they do, I'll leave that out to the American military. I do know that from
what's been
released so
far. You don't think those pictures exist?
No, I don't think that if they've got pictures of a cadaver, then there's probably more going on than we suspect in what happened there.
But just so I understand that, when you say you don't think the pictures exist, people want to see, just explain exactly why you think there might not be pictures of the cadaver of and the body of Osama bin Laden.
Well, I guess you'd have to, it's very difficult to explain a negative proposition. You're affirming that they do exist. If the Americans say that such things do exist, then it'll be up to them to release them.
I only infer because they say they won't release a photo. That implies that they have a photo.
Possibly. I don't honestly believe that it's germane. I think that if the Americans have taken pictures in that circumstance, it won't be able to prove very much. I don't think that we're going to get very far with this debate on that.
All right, so there's some controversial comments. Thomas Mulcair, newly minted NDP MP, coming out of Quebec there, and actually probably a leader in Quebec. And speaking, you know, his mind, probably a mind that is shared with many Canadians, probably more than not. But of course, he's lambasted for that. You know, you don't speak on national television and doubt the word of the president of the United States. It's just ridiculous. Like, the president, the government's a lie. And, you know, Osama bin Laden's cozying up with the policy of the Bush, just a continuation of Bush, is just like, oh, come on. Actually, I see this as a confirmation of continuity of government, the connection between the two regimes, Bush and Obama, is obvious right there. And actually, I got a clip here from I'm going to drop this one. I've been holding off on this one. I don't have time to play it, but I'm going to play it anyway. I just want to drop this Alex Jones with Webster Tarpley. I'm going to get quickly to the previous extrajudicial killings, and we'll be right back. I have to drop this one. ZKLN, Plunder News, 9/11.
Tarpley, what's your view?
Good question, Alex. Remember, the left liberals always believed in and needed the 9/11 myth even more than Bush and Cheney. Bush and Cheney were, of course, they built their house on 9/11 and the myth of bin Laden as the enemy image. But before too long, they shifted off. They had Saddam Hussein. They had Iraq. They had all sorts of other things. Whereas the left liberals stuck with the myth about 9/11. And this is the roots of this, what we see with Obama, right? That Iraq was the bad war and the mistaken war, but Afghanistan, of course, was the good war that had to be escalated, and that's, of course, what he's been doing. And it's clear to us that the real purpose of the Afghan war is to attack Pakistan, to export the Afghan civil war into Pakistan, also for a deeper reason, that the left liberal wanted to believe that this group of Arab terrorists had been able to bring the United States to its knees, because this was the blowback thesis. They wanted to believe in the blowback thesis, which is a way of saying...
And America deserved it.
Yes, exactly.
That was the Ward Churchill tripe about the 3,000 exactly. that died were little Eichmanns, those little kids visiting mommy, the secretary. They deserved it.
Exactly. So there's a deep emotional need to believe in the myth, because the idea is that just punishment was meted out to the United States on 9/11. This is, of course, absolute baloney. There is no collective guilt. This was done by a network. The American people do not bear the collective guilt for this in any way. And, of course, the irony with bin Laden is that how many battles did he fight after his death, right? The best guess is that he died somewhere between 2001 and 2002. This is what the Pakistani government has said. It's been announced by FBI officials and others in these little red press things.
Who was the British main minister, Robin Page? A week after he went public, he had the heart attack and died. Correct, that's the name on him.
Robin Cook.
Robin Cook. Actually, I had his statements printed out yesterday and then lost them, and I can't keep all the names straight. We also had Sybil Edmonds. We had Benazir Bhutto, the president. She said it. They killed her. I mean, they kill major government people when they touch this myth, because they had a special narrative to unwind later.
Well, unfortunately, it just doesn't add up, right? And you have to be very gullible to believe the greatest liars of the age when they come with another one after all the ones you've mentioned.
Remember, yeah. So that's the point I wanted to make. You know, there's already been, how many times has Osama bin Laden been killed? And now there's this big production killing, which I guess explains the previous extradition killings that they just mentioned there of foreign politicians. And due to the need to hold off on this message until, you know, just at this time, you know. It's just continuation of policy. What is his name? Henry Kissinger? I see him as the leader of a globalist attack. All right, we're going to move into some Canadian stuff here. Come on, stop. That's a clip there from Alex Jones. It was with Webster Tarpley. I don't have the date, but if you wanted to search it up, it's on YouTube under "The Next False Flag Terror Op Will Be Blamed on Pakistan." So it obviously goes on to talk about the next false flag terror operation will be blamed on Pakistan. And this is sort of the seeds of that. Alex goes on to basically say that there will be a catastrophic attack on the United States, and it will be blamed on Pakistan, which will, I guess, then lead to invasion of Pakistan and World War III. Again, yeah, everything seems to lead to World War III. All right. My name is Shannon. You're listening to Plunder News. I'm going to read this article now. NDP's success undermines its influence. It's written by Thomas Walcombe. It was published on May 5th in Toronto Star. For New Democrats, their party's new role as Canada's official opposition is the best news possible. Better even than an outright win. For those who voted for the NDP, hoping that Jack Layton would deliver on his promise of practical solutions for working families, are sure to be disappointed. The reason is simple. In a majority government, an opposition party, an official or not, has no control over the government's agenda. Indeed, the irony of the NDP position is that even with 102 common seats, it will have less leverage over Stephen Harper's Conservatives than it did when it had just 37. Layton didn't get much from Harper's minority governments, but he was able to wrest some things in return for his support, including more employment insurance benefits for the jobless. That kind of thing won't happen again. True, some measures the NDP called for in the campaign, including an increase in payments for the poorest elderly, as well as a tax break for volunteer firefighters, will go ahead. However, that's only because the Harper government, or Harper Conservatives, made similar or identical promises. The governing conservatives may also cherry-pick items from the NDP platform that fit their own agenda, such as making carjacking a separate criminal offense. But the NDP's call for more money to train new family doctors, unlikely. The conservatives will almost certainly stick instead with their plans to encourage existing doctors to move to unserviced areas. The boosting of the Canada Pension Plan payroll taxes to increase benefits? No way. As long as Alberta and Quebec are opposed. Harper has already nixed NDP infrastructure spending ideas, and its free market conservatives will not accede to NDP demands for a cap on credit card interest rates. Layton talks of being practical and constructive, but unless the conservatives see it in their political interest to pump up the NDP to denigrate the Liberals, as Ontario Tory Premier Bill Davis did famously in the 70s, Harper will pay him no heed. Incidentally, the end of minority government also means the end of independent commons committees that many Canadians found so useful. The Commons inquiry into the treatment of Afghan prisoners, for instance, terminated with the end of the last parliament without reaching any conclusion, and whether it will be reconstituted anew depends entirely on Harper. And actually, in regards to that, if Harper doesn't open up the deal with this issue, the Afghani detainee torture issue, if he doesn't deal with that, there's a good chance that it'll be taken up internationally. So he might actually want to take that up. Anyway, getting back to the article. Where Layton's success on Monday will prove invaluable, however, is in the NDP's preparation for the 2015 election, which I'm going to get into next. First, the party will get more attention. Outside of election time, the media routinely ignores New Democrats. Now that the NDP is within striking distance of government, this benign neglect will end. Layton will be on television and in the press constantly. Secondly, the NDP will get more money. Harper has pledged to phase out the per-vote subsidy for political parties over the next 4 years. But even under his new formula, the newly vote-rich New Democrats will receive about $13.5 million in public funds before the next election. More importantly, the possibility of the NDP eventually forming a government will almost certainly encourage the party supporters to donate more. But Layton's real gain is that Canadians now see him as a serious contender for power. Had the NDP won Monday and its caucus of novices slapdash approach to policy, it could have well imploded. But 4 years from now, by then it should be ready to govern. And by then, more voters might be accustomed to the idea of a new Democrat as Prime Minister. All right, so I do have one more article to read on that, on the election issue, but in regards to that article by Thomas Walcom, this is actually the best possible situation for Layton, and to train his MPs, get them ready to fight the to become government in 4 years, and break Canadians into the idea of the possibility of a social democratic government in Canada. And it gives us time to, actually with the Liberals having to rebuild, there'll be lots of policy discussion. And that's what I will be getting into. That's why I want to play this Chomsky interview on social democracy, or not social democracy. Chomsky's dealing with anarchism or social anarchism or libertarianism, which are two big issues in the United States. But the reason why I want to get into that is that the Liberals may want to listen to this piece. I'm going to be posting it on the internet, and it's going to be good food for thought and policy building into the future for Canadians. Actually, talking about the future, and Layton, his big ticket could be proportional representation. As everybody knows, that only 40% of Canadians voted for the Conservative government, and 60% didn't, meaning the majority of Canadians didn't vote for a government. And when you take into the fact that 40% of Canadians didn't even vote. And they don't count in the 40%. So it means, you know, less than 30% Canadians voted for the Conservative government. 25-30% Canadians voted for the government. 40% of the voters voted for the government. So proportional representation, I think, is a big ticket for the NDP to win the next election. And Canadians would vote for the NDP if they were going to be given proportional representation. And just to summarize, proportional representation is the idea that that if the NDP receives 30% of the vote, they would have 30% of the members of parliament in there, meaning that the Green Party should receive maybe, I don't know what they got, 10% of the vote. Then they would have 10% of the MPs in parliament. Out of the 300, 10% would be 30 MPs for the Green, using proportional representation. And I think that, you know, Canada really needs this, and democracy in Canada really needs it. And it would be a good ticket, the big ticket, for the NDP to win the next election. Didn't have the statistic there on the Greens. The Greens actually received only 0.32%, 1/3%. So they'd only have about 3 MPs instead of the 1 that they actually got. Elizabeth May did get in this time. NDP at 33%, which is about... Anyway, okay, we got to move on. It's 9:23. This is Plunder News. My name is Shannon. We're discussing the Canadian election. Now, we're going to do one more clip. We're going to take a little break here and do one more clip. This is a little thing I got off the current Rebooting Civilization. I think we'll catch the guy's name. Bob Holmes is making a statement here of another type of parliamentary order or democratic order that was interesting. Actually, I just heard this the first time. It's not proportional representation, which I think is a little more mainstream of an idea. This is an even newer idea. So I'm putting it out there as just an idea. And this is Bob Holmes. My name is Shannon. You're listening to Plunder News.
So for those who might want a total reboot of the political system, have you got another way?
Well, there is a suggestion out there on the table, at least. As you said, right now, about 60% of voters ended up with a government that they didn't want, that they preferred someone else. And the suggestion is you could have 100% satisfied voters if every voter was to be governed by the party they voted for.
What do you call that? Choice democracy?
They call it choice democracy. Yeah, it's a brand new idea from a Swiss economist who's really just developing the thought right now.
What does that mean, though? If we were all governed by the people we voted for, how would it work?
The idea would be that each party would lay out their platform. They'd lay out, you know, the taxes that they would levy, the services they'd provide, the laws that we'd live by, and voters would pick one and essentially enter a formal contract with that party to, you know, to pay taxes to that party, to receive the services delivered by the party.
So if I paid taxes because I wanted services that my neighbor didn't want, we'd have different tax systems and different services.
Mm-hmm. And in fact, that happens right now. Two people working at adjacent desks in Ottawa, one can live on the Quebec side of the river and pay Quebec taxes and be governed by Quebec laws, while the other one lives on the Ottawa side, on the Ontario side, and pays Ontario taxes.
That's called federal-provincial fighting, isn't it?
It is.
Not choice democracy.
Well, I'm sure there'd be fighting here, too, but at least in principle, it could work.
It's just, we're going to get right back into political futures. Just going to read this one quick more article from Rick Salutin. It's called "What Was the Surge All About Anyway? Democracy? Not." So what was the NDP surge about? I'd say it had nothing to do with the NDP. Why? Because the party did little different from what it did in previous campaigns under the same leader, who behaved as he always has. This entitles us to speculate on what really drew voters to them. What happened last election when the same platform, same leaders, and tactics produced negligible results? Only the worst economic crisis since the 30s. Western economies became so financialized that bankers, hedge funds, and insurance firms had to be bailed out with public funds because they were too big to fail. Then, instead of acting so it wouldn't happen again, they grew greedier, refused to change, and demanded the same citizens who rescued them pay the ongoing costs through cuts in health care, schools, pension funds, etc. Though Canada avoided the worst of the crisis, we're seeing the aftermath in all the proposed cuts to services that the Harper government will now make. It seems to me that the general reaction to avoiding the crisis was relief, but the reaction to the gluttonous aftermath has been rage and disgust, none of which found voice in established parties or institutions. It's enough to make you start wondering if you're having a private flame out, but you still find it, and the fury seeks expression where it can. And I'd say that this fuels the Tea Party in the United States, the rioting in Greece, and yes, the NDP. Okay, it's a theory, but Quebec, where the NDP ignited, has long been the province most sensitive to social injustice. And if the Bloc got punished, I'd say it was for taking up independence, while economic depravity was the real concern. It's less a protest against politicians than against the ugly drift of society and the unseemly division of its spoils. The NDP was well positioned to benefit from these angry feelings because they've never held power. Parties like them, which have, such as Tony Blair's Labour in the UK or Barack Obama's Democrats, have shown that they'll do nothing really to address the injustice. For the NDP, that hope hasn't been dashed yet. Jack Layton's sunny personality helped, since Canadians typically don't like to show much anger when they feel it, except when on the ice or in foreign wars. The NDP's government virginity also helped. They really believe they're different, even if nothing in the program proves it or explains why they'd act differently. If the thesis of underlying rage sounds far-fetched, consider this. Even in the U.S., where big banks are 20% larger than before the crisis, a Florida town meeting erupted in near chaos, according to the New York Times, over Medicare cuts and corporate giveaways. And in a recent poll, found less public support for the free market economy in the United States than there is in China. You could see a cheerful unconcern about what got them there in Jack's post-election pronouncements. He blurbed about what he'd do in cooperation with the government that doesn't need him anymore. I don't begrudge him this enthusiasm, but a hint of empathy for many Canadians who will have to suck it up for the next 4 years might also have found a place. It's odd that those rare NDP breakthroughs seem to involve bad news for the country. The last came in 1998, when they collected 43 seats. But a big Tory majority passed free trade, the kind of idea that led to the crisis of 2008. I'm not blaming Jack or the NDP. They play by the rules like anyone else. To some extent, it's the fault of the rotten system we inherited. We now live in a permanent state you could call the tyranny of the minority. You could also call it the tragedy of the majority. We'll have had 10 years of government desired by 40% of the voters, while 60% who largely agree on what they'd like will get zero representation. Everyone played by the rules of the game, but it's a stretch to call that democracy. So that leads me back to proportional representation. I think we all know what proportional representation is, and perhaps I'll get into it at a later date.